Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thanks to so many of you for turning out. Today, I know there's a lot of competition on campus right now. In particular, there's a screening of Rekha Basu's mother's documentary about the suicides of farmers in the Punjab region of India. So we appreciate your commitment to our program. The cookies had nothing to do with it, I'm sure. My name is Tim Knepper. As many of you know, I teach philosophy and religion here at Drake University and also direct the Comparison Project, which now has two wings, a lecture and a lecture and dialogue series in comparative religion that takes a particular topic and explores it from the perspective of different religious traditions. We've been working on death and dying, as many of you know, for 2 years, and we're about to come to the end of that in May, and then we'll be moving on to the topic of miracles starting in the fall. Also, we're doing increased work with local lived religion in the greater Des Moines area, and to that effect, our next event actually will not be a lecture and dialogue series, but will be the book launch for our student-written photo narrative on religion in Des Moines. I'm told that sometime between now and Saturday, the books are coming off the press, finally. Yeah, it's getting exciting. 2 weeks from tonight is the book launch. That's in Parents Hall at 6 p.m. Rekha Basu, back on campus. This time we have her as MC for the event, and Ibu Patel, who established Interfaith Youth Corps and served the Obama administration in a number of ways. He's coming to be our keynote. And also the next day to kick off a two-day interfaith conference that we're hosting here at Drake and involves campuses, organizations, and so forth from across Iowa to talk about what they're doing in the way of interfaith, multicultural, and social justice work. I encourage you to learn more about that. There's some information outside. There's information on our website and other websites about that. All this programming requires support. We thank all the generous support that we receive from seven sources: Drake's Center for the Humanities, Drake's Principal Financial Group Center for Global Citizenship, the Medbury Fund, Humanities Iowa, the Des Moines Area Religious Council, Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, the Slave Fund for Social Justice, and Isles Funeral Homes, which is our special series sponsor for the program on death and dying. As you also know, one of our sponsors, Humanities Iowa, requires us to take attendance at our events. To that effect, we're sending around the binder with new, spacious, big blocks in which you can write your email addresses legibly. If you want to be on our emailing list or Humanities Iowa's emailing list, you can write your email address in the nice big blocks legibly. Otherwise, just write your name down and that'll give us a head count for tonight. Let's move on, shall we? We're so honored and thrilled to have back at Drake tonight, and this time I'm going to pronounce her name right. Michaeline, no I'm not. That's right. I'm not going to get the other part. Basantabi. I was butchering it as Micheline Pesantubby. Michaeline Pesantubby. I'm so sorry. She came to us, it was 4 years ago when we were just getting off the ground and doing an exploratory series on religious responses to suffering. And she gave what for me was the bestest lecture in the whole darn program. It was on dance as a response to suffering in a couple Native American traditions. And that's the moral I took, that's the lesson I took. That was the comparative gold for me in that series, how important community and embodied practice is in the way of a response to suffering, rather than highfalutin and abstract theodicies and theologies. Well, she's back. This time to give a talk on death and dying in Native American traditions, particularly Navajo. She's an associate professor of religious studies and American Indian Native Studies at the University of Iowa. She specializes in Native American religious traditions, especially Native American women and religious change and Native American religious movements. She's particularly interested in how contact experiences with European and European Americans affected Native American religious practices and Native women's lives. She's the author of Choctaw Women in a Chaotic World, which examines how contact experiences with the French and British led to significant changes in Choctaw women's lives, and which one reviewer lauded as an example of sterling scholarship and significant contribution to the scholarly literature on ethnicity and gender. She's also the author of numerous articles and book chapters on Native American religious movements that arise in response to colonization, especially her essays on Native American responses to the massacre at Wounded Knee, such as Wounded Knee, Symbol of Resistance and Recovery, and From Vision to Violence, the Wounded Knee Massacre. And she's currently working on a book project about the role of Native American women in selected religious movements. Please join me in welcoming our lecturer for tonight, Michaeline Passantabee.
I should just give him the English translation and see if he gets that one right. It's to see and kill. So didn't want to scare him, though. Well, good evening. It's wonderful to be here again. I'm delighted to be able to share tonight with you some thoughts about medicalization and Native American theologies of death. I don't know that it'll be as interesting as dance, but we'll see what happens. Anyway, I must confess that this is not my area of expertise, but I found myself intrigued by the topic, and I'm not sure if it's mostly due to the fact that I have more years behind me than I do in front of me, but I'm ready to take it on, so here we go. In any case, before I embark on the subject of death, I want to take just a few moments to unpack the idea of anything Native American, because this is a term that subsumes a wide variety of cultures under one misnomer. In the United States, there are 566 federally recognized tribes. That does not include state recognized tribes or non-federally recognized tribes. That does not include those that they're not recognized, but they have organized as tribes in this country. They're a mixture of different tribal ethnic groups that have created one unique kind of tribal unit. I'm not quite sure how to describe them, but anyway, all of these tribes have distinct cultures and religious traditions that we cannot, with any integrity, treat as one coherent religious group. We can try to get around the issue by talking about a particular tribal nation's religious ideas, but even that presents problems as community and family experiences vary a lot. People also have differing degrees of knowledge or involvement in traditional ceremonies. So who we talk to matters. Many people identify as Native American, but may have little or no knowledge of tribal cultures. According to the 2010 United States Census, 5.2 million people identified themselves as being of Native American descent. And I would wager that a large percentage of those people know very little about their tribal culture, language, or history. The vast majority of Native Americans, 78%, live outside of Native American or Alaskan Native communities and thus have little opportunity to participate in their tribal traditions. Among those people who did grow up in their tribal communities, I mean reservations, very few spent time studying their tribal religious traditions. Unlike religious groups that have written sacred texts and organized structures of leadership, Native Americans do not have systematic courses of study, systems of accreditation, or formal discussions of the nature of God or beliefs. One learns by observation or instruction from a local specialist, and one cannot do that at least not effectively, without spending extended time in the community. It is also difficult to separate Native American traditions from Christian ones. All Native American communities have been exposed to Christianity for at least 300 years, and for some, more than 500 years. Many Native Americans identify as Christian, others identify as traditional and Christian, and among those who identify as traditional, some engage in intertribal traditions or in the traditions of a tribal community other than their ancestral one. So you can see how difficult this is, if not downright foolish, to try to construct a picture of Native American or a specific tribal perspective on death and ritual. So I don't know what this says about me, but that is exactly what I'm going to try to do tonight. So since it's somewhat easier to generalize about a specific tribal nation rather than some amorphous group called Native Americans, I decided to focus on the Navajo Nation for a couple of reasons. First, the size and location of the Navajo Reservation in the Southwest have helped the Navajo to retain their language and culture to a much greater degree than many other Native nations. At least half the population still speaks fluent Navajo, and the percentage of Navajo who participate in traditional ways is relatively high compared to many other Native communities in the United States. Second, the Navajo Nation is the second largest Native American nation in the United States, with a population of 332,000. And 60% of those live on the reservation, a much higher percentage than we find among many other tribes. The Navajo Reservation also has the largest number of people identifying with one tribe only. So that high level of cultural retention among Navajo, I think, offers us a good chance, I might be being a little bold there, but a good chance of assessing the effects of medicalization, at least on this group in particular. So I have to make one more qualification before I start talking on specifics. I want to also acknowledge that although Navajo recognize a general version of their origin story and related ceremonies, details or attributes vary from person to person. Navajo religious specialists, referred to in English as singers or chanters, learn their vocation typically from someone in their family or in the community. The practice of handing down songs, prayers, or medicine bundles and rituals means that although there is a recognized format and content for specific ceremonies, variations do exist. I'm sharing all of this with you. It may seem like a lot of background here, but I'm sharing it with you as a way of qualifying my talk tonight by acknowledging that my interpretation of Navajo experiences is based upon whose work I've read or people I've talked to and does not represent any particular or all Navajo perspectives. I also am not Navajo. I'm Choctaw, Passantabe, to see and kill. So I offer an outsider's understanding of Navajo religious traditions that I'm sure some Navajo may find a bit curious, to put it nicely. Okay, so let's start. The first thing I want to mention is that outsiders often mischaracterize Navajo ideas about death. Some people have portrayed them as dreadfully afraid of death. In fact, Navajos do not have an unreasonable fear of death, but rather, as Gary Witherspoon puts it, they have a tremendous respect for life. Just like the rest of us, they don't look forward to dying, but they understand that death is part of the natural cycle of life. The confusion arises, I think, from the fact that traditionally, Navajo avoid contact with the dead or talking about a deceased person, again, not because they are afraid of the dead, but because the spirit of the dead may still remain near the physical remains and cause harm to those who ignore customary restrictions. And I want to make another qualification here. I may be doing a lot of this tonight. I use the word spirit. Some people use ghost. Arguably, the best word is wind. Ghost is a word that Europeans, Americans, missionaries used because they could not figure out how to translate what the Navajo were saying. And I think when we use the word ghost, leads us in the wrong direction when we're trying to figure out what they're talking about or what they think. Okay. So while changes in Navajo burial practices might be a delightful subject to discuss, I'm not going to specifically address burial practices because a lot has already been written on that, particularly the impact of Christianity and economic changes on traditional practices. Instead, I'm going to talk about how Navajo concepts of death affect their participation in end-of-life services and directives. Now, interestingly, end-of-life directives is a fairly recent phenomenon in the United States. The concept of living wills, which allows patients to instruct physicians on what life-sustaining measures they want, was first introduced in 1967. I know that sounds like a long time ago for some of you, but believe me, it's not. Not long after that, health professionals began advocating for durable powers of attorney in which a patient can designate someone else to make medical decisions on their behalf. Within 30 years, every state had enacted a policy. By the early 1990s, states began passing do not resuscitate legislation. However, in spite of the healthcare profession's efforts to encourage Americans to prepare end-of-life directives, their success has been pretty disappointing, and even more so among Native Americans. However, what I want to talk about tonight are some targeted Navajo programs that have led to some unexpected high rates of participation. This change in attitude among Navajos is intriguing because Navajo are considered reticent to talk about end-of-life issues, and they have a history of not trusting hospitals. This leads me to ask, what happened to change Navajo minds about preparing end-of-life directives? In order to answer the question, we need to have some understanding of Navajo concepts of life and death. So let's start with life. That's happier, right? For Navajos, air, or what some call wind, is equated with life. They identify seven classes of wind souls. One called the small wind or little inner wind enters the fetus once the fetus has developed into human shape or human form. If some of you have ever wondered what enables the fetus to kick and move around at the most inopportune times, the Navajo would say it's the small wind. The small wind enables the fetus to move and controls its digestive system. After birth, the small wind remains with the baby and helps it to continue to grow. However, upon birth, the child acquires a second wind called the instanding wind soul. The instanding wind soul controls the functioning of the brain, which in turn controls a person's thoughts and bodily movements. So what we can gather about the relationship of air and life, according to Navajo thought, is that air makes life possible and life is manifested in movement. To quote Gary Witherspoon again, movement is the basis of life and life is exemplified by movement. Okay, so since air or the breath of life is the source or power of movement, as evidenced by the little wind and the instanding wind soul, when air leaves the body, movement ceases to occur and life ends. But why must movement cease? Why must life end? Why does the wind leave the body? The answer for the Navajo lies in their origin story. In their story, it is told that first man and first woman originally wanted people to live forever. However, the sun told the people that as payment for the light he provides, he would claim lives. When first man and first woman saw deceased people in the below world, it made them unhappy, and they decided to try to change things. So they threw a log into the lake, saying that if it floats, people will live forever. But if it sinks, people will die. About that time, Old Coyote came along and proceeded to toss a stone into the water, declaring that if the stone doesn't float, then there will be death. And of course, we all know what happens next, right? The stone sank. The people were upset, but Coyote explained to them that death had to be part of the scheme of this world. If death did not occur, the earth would soon be overcrowded, and there would be no room for cornfields or for future generations. He told the people, "It is better that each one of us should live for a limited time on this earth and then leave and make room for the children." Okay, it's from this story that the Navajo understand that death is not an evil willed upon the world by Coyote or some other force, but rather more an unavoidable necessity. That brings us to the next question. If death is an unavoidable necessity, then one must consider how and when death should occur. For Navajo, a natural and highly desirable death is one that results from old age. I think we can all agree with that. This reasoning derives in part from Navajo understanding that birth and death are structural opposites. One cannot exist without the other. Going to Gary Witherspoon again, he explains, life is considered to be a cycle which reaches its natural conclusion in death of old age and is renewed in birth. Death occurs so that birth is possible. Okay, so the Navajo have accepted this, but their stories also tell of a time when one of their culture heroes, Monster Slayer, and I don't want to give you too many details, but this is the daughter of one of their, the son of one of their deities, Changing Woman. Monster Slayer tried to kill Old Age. Old Age spoke up and said, "In spite of all, I am going to live on, my grandchild. Should you kill me, dying would cease. Then too, giving birth would cease. And this present number of people would continue in the same amount for all time to come." In other words, the dynamic flux of the universe, that motion which continually recreates order, would cease, and so too would the world. This made sense to the Navajo because they witnessed this pattern of motion throughout the universe. In spring, plants bloom. In winter, they die. The sun rises, the sun sets. If plants quit growing and the sun quits rising, the world would end. So too must birth and death continue in order for the life cycle to continue. Okay, to just kind of keep this going, if a desirable death is one that occurs from old age, then how do the Navajo account or explain death by any other means? Okay, for Navajo, death before old age is considered unnatural and tragic, because it prevents the natural completion of the life cycle. Premature death is believed to result from malevolent intentions and deeds. Let me say that again. Premature death is believed to result from malevolent intentions and deeds. Throughout one's life, a Navajo strives to live according to Hojong, a life of beauty, harmony, and happiness. However, malevolent forces exist, and if they are not discovered and transformed into benevolent ones, death can occur before old age is reached. Okay, now to understand the existence of malevolent forces and the need to avoid them, we now have to look at Navajo conceptions of illness. Sorry I'm taking you on such a long route here to get to end-of-life directives, but I hope all this will help. We all know illness or injury have physical causes, and they manifest symptoms, right? The question for Navajos is what brought about those physical causes. Navajo understand the physical manifestation of illness to be due to impaired relationships or states of imbalance. Their creation stories teach them that they should maintain proper spiritual relationships with the Dien Dine'e, or the holy people. They must properly carry out their responsibilities to the environment, They must execute proper ceremonial practices, and they must maintain harmony with each other. When Navajo fail to maintain proper relationships and attitudes, illness results. Illness, then, is the result of behavior that leads to disharmony. As Griffin Pierce explains, when people engage in acts that disrupt the balance in the forces of nature, they may be made ill by the forces thereby unleashed. If the holy people are offended, they may direct life-threatening influences towards the offending person, leading to a state of imbalance or malevolence. The illness is overcome when balance, or hojong, is restored through ceremony. As Jenny Jo explains, the central aim of all Navajo healing ceremonies is not to cure the physical ailments, but rather to empower the patient so he or she can work towards restoring balance or harmony of mind, body, and spirit. Navajo engage in ceremony in order to reestablish proper relationships with the holy people and to compel them to remove the spell causing the illness. The prayer obligates the holy people to remove the spell and allows the person to return to a state of health. So I wanted to just read a short excerpt from a Holy Way prayer. Holy Way prayers are used when someone is sick, not an injury, but sick, ill. And so I want to read it so you can hear a little bit about how the prayer works. So at the beginning of the prayer, something is said to obligate the holy being. It's then followed with something like this. This very day, you must take your spell out of me by which you are bothering me. This very day, you have removed your spell from me by which you were bothering me. What you might notice in these two sentences is this is not typical of prayers as we think of them. They're actually beseeching the holy being to take the illness out. You must take it out. They're compelling them. And if they do it right, the holy beings have to respond. Okay? It's not a choice. In the second line, where the act of recovery is initiated, you have removed your spell. What the Navajo believe is that the thought and the articulation of that thought through voice, that can be chants, songs, prayers, if that's done, it actually causes change. So for them to properly say a prayer in the correct ritual manner doesn't describe what has happened. It is telling you what is happening. It's causing it to happen for Navajo. Okay, I hope that's clear. So after going through the ceremonial process, you know, sick people still die. The person may die. So one might assume in such a case that Navajo would lose faith in the ceremony, but one would be wrong. Ceremonial response to illness is not questioned in such cases, but rather the diagnosis, location or timing of the ceremony, or the performance of the ceremony are questioned. If the diagnosis is incorrect, then the wrong ceremonial was probably performed or was inadequate, or the chanter did not perform the ceremony in a properly consecrated enclosure, or perhaps during the appropriate season of the year. In other words, if the ceremony is not carried out exactly as required by conventions, or the participants do not have the proper intentions or adhere to applicable restrictions, then the ceremony will fail to cure the person. If the ceremony does not cure the person the first time, the Navajos may repeat the ceremony several times over a period of time. If the ceremony continues to be ineffective, then as a last resort, Navajo might take the ill person to a hospital. By waiting for the proper season or time and repeating the ceremony several times, and some of those ceremonies take up to 8 days to complete, a Navajo might not be taken to the hospital until their illness is quite advanced and the patient's chances of survival low. This delayed action contributed to Navajo perceptions that hospitals are houses of death. So many people died in the hospitals that Navajos began to say no one could get well in places so polluted by the winds or the ghosts of the dead. It's important to understand that the high rates of death in hospitals resulted from more than just delayed hospitalization. In an article by the National Cancer Institute, they noted that although as a group, Native Americans and Alaska Natives have lower rates of most types of cancers than non-Hispanic white Americans, they are more likely to be diagnosed with late stage disease, and their cancer survival is generally poorer than that of other groups. Before the advent of antibiotics, Navajo suffered high fatality rates from upper respiratory infections and tuberculosis. So it's no wonder that the Navajo associated hospitals with death. Their distrust of hospitals also stemmed from the way in which hospital personnel responded to illness. The difference between Navajo and Western responses is clearly seen in an event that Gary Witherspoon observed on the Navajo Reservation in 1969. In his book, he tells a story about an 82-year-old woman who suddenly became ill. She was quickly taken to a hospital where she fell into a coma, and the hospital kept her alive by intravenous feeding. The family decided to consult a diviner who diagnosed her case as being caused by contact with the ghost of a deceased non-Navajo and prescribed the 3-day enemy way rite. When the family informed the doctors that they wanted her released so that the enemy way rite could be performed, the doctors tried to stop them by telling them that if she was taken off intravenous feeding, she would soon die. Despite the risk, the family decided to take her home anyway and had the rite performed. Before the 3 days were up, she regained consciousness and was eating and talking and was soon up and walking about. In this particular case, what we see is that the doctors had little confidence in Navajo healing ceremonies that focused on restoring Hojon, and the Navajos had little faith in Western medicine that concerned itself with physical symptoms and physiological causes rather than curing the disease by restoring balance. Neither understood the other's concern about how to care for someone facing death. Now, this lack of understanding isn't unusual. During their early years, the Indian Health Service, which I'll refer to as IHS from now on, the Indian Health Service and other hospitals serving Native Americans did not always welcome or accommodate the services of traditional tribal practitioners. Nor did they try to find ways to address Navajo concerns. However, in the 1990s, attitudes began to change. The federal government gradually began to recognize the importance of cultural traditions in delivering health care of Native Americans. And in 1994, then-director of the IHS, Michael H. Trujillo, a Native American physician, issued an administrative initiative asking all regional IHS facilities to find ways to work more closely with local Native practitioners. 6 years later, Chin Lee Comprehensive Healthcare Facility officially opened their Office of Native Medicine with the hiring of the first traditional Navajo practitioner. One of the objectives of ONM was to provide cultural sensitivity training to healthcare providers by providing educational programs about Navajo medicine, healing, culture, and language. Ironically, by providing cultural sensitivity training to hospital staff, ONM reinforced staff resistance to discussion of end-of-life decisions with Navajo patients and their family. It had just the opposite effect. As medical personnel became aware of Navajo beliefs about death, And their idea that talking about it is thought to bring it about, again, the power of thought, they did not want to raise the topic of end-of-life directives with Navajo patients. They avoided discussing preparation for death with the family. They didn't want to offend Navajo, and they didn't want to risk Navajo avoidance of hospitals for fear of causing death of their relatives. In other words, if they talked about death, they would cause the person to die, their relative. Yet hospital staff still needed to bring up the subject because Navajo were bringing in dying patients, particularly elderly patients who spoke only Navajo. Not only did the Navajo tend to delay taking their gravely ill relatives to the hospital, they also started taking their dying relatives to the hospital in order to avoid some of their restrictions associated with the care of the deceased. Traditionally, when someone was gravely ill, several close members of the family and the healers stayed with the sick person until they were certain death was near. Then everyone left except for one or two people who performed the necessary rites. The family also made sure that outsiders were warned about the impending death so that then and later they would stay away from the area. After the person died, the hogan, a traditional Navajo house, the hogan in which the death occurred was burned or abandoned, and mourners spent the 4 days of seclusion in another dwelling. By taking the dying to the hospital, Navajo avoided having to abandon the hogan where the person died. And as Dates explained, it's I think one of the articles the students read, many Navajo are too poor to afford to relocate and build another hogan. So this made sense to them. It was a good alternative. All of these factors contributed to Navajo perceptions that hospitals are places to take those nearing death. Hospitals became places to die. And yet Navajo were reluctant to talk about death with the very people they had entrusted with their loved ones. Healthcare providers and Navajo healers needed to find ways to accommodate and integrate the practices of the other in order to meet the needs of Navajo facing end-of-life decisions in IHS hospitals. So now let's fast forward to 2006. We've left the 90s. Dr. Timothy Dahmer, a geriatrician who practiced medicine on the Navajo reservation for years, decided to start a home-based care program. When he reviewed the hospital records of Navajo patients at Fort Defiance Indian Hospital in northeastern Arizona, he found zero advanced directives in their charts, zero. The absence of health directives in Navajo medical charts is consistent with what a 2005 NCI-funded study of IHS tribal health directors found, which was that a majority of Native American communities were not receiving advanced care planning, bereavement support, care for the dying, or hospice care. Dr. Dahmer wanted to find a way to work with his terminal patients and their families and change the way dying Navajo live. But first, he had to find a way to sensitively address Navajo ideas about death and medical providers' perception that Navajos are unwilling to discuss end-of-life issues. Healthcare providers had long held that Navajo elders will not openly discuss issues related to death and dying. 86% of healthcare providers interviewed for a study considered advanced care planning a dangerous violation of traditional Navajo values. The authors reported that discussing negative information, such as end-of-life care, was considered culturally offensive and potentially harmful. And the IHS manual clearly stated that medical personnel must respect a patient's tribal customs and traditional beliefs that relate to death and dying whenever possible. However, an individual patient's preference and beliefs take precedent over his tribal customs and traditional beliefs. If that's not clear, what I'm saying is that these end-of-life directives and the state rules around them take precedent over those tribal customs if the individual signs those documents, okay? So Dr. Dahmer needed to find a way to get his staff to accept the charge of discussing end-of-life issues with Navajo patients and their families. This was not an easy task. He held several meetings to discuss the issue, and as he recalls, 9 years ago we weren't having much success. We came out of end-of-life conversations feeling drained and frustrated, and our staff wasn't comfortable. He explained that the biggest problem that they had to overcome is the reluctance of staff to bring up issues with the patients. So he asked the hospital social workers to come up with a plan that used words and images that were culturally acceptable for end-of-life discussions, and they did. Since broaching the subject of death was frowned upon, Mrs. Began, the cross-cultural coordinator for the home-based care program at Fort Defiance Indian Hospital, and her staff came up with an approach to opening the doors to discussing living wills and advanced directives with Navajo patients. They created a poem, a part of which goes as follows. When that time comes, when my last breath leaves me, I choose to die in peace to meet Shadien, the Creator. This poem was consistent with Navajo beliefs and opened the door to further discussion. According to Dr. Dahmer, 90% of the patients in the home-based care program have signed the poem and other standard directives. They went from 0 to 90%. Once the staff became comfortable with the subject and knew the right words to use, he found that the Navajo were often quite willing and often eager to have these discussions and formally establish their advanced directives and durable medical powers of attorney. Okay, why did the poem work? One reason it works is that it is a directive of the Navajo's choosing. Okay, that's important, right? Advanced directives also, in some ways, are consistent with Navajo traditional practices. Many older Navajo will often distribute some of their personal property to relatives in anticipation of death. They don't talk about death, but they realize it's coming, okay? So they may announce their wishes in front of a gathering of relatives to ensure their wishes are carried out. They might leave sheep permits to particular relatives. Others distribute jewelry or even songs, chants, or medicine bundles. Some traditional Navajo have been known to ask a missionary or other white person to prepare their wills. They may also let their relatives know how they want their body prepared for burial. In other words, Navajo already employed verbal directives to make sure their wishes are known, and the poem served to make the connection between traditional Navajo directives and state health directives, as well as Navajo concepts of death. You heard the mention of breath, the wind. When the wind leaves the body, that's death. They're acknowledging that. Although the program is considered successful, advanced directives raised other cultural issues for Navajos. In a case study on patient-centered care at Chin Lee Comprehensive Healthcare Facility, Jenny Jo and her co-authors related the following story. A 45-year-old patient on dialysis wanted to discontinue this procedure against the family's wishes. As the patient's health was failing, the family requested the help of ONM, that's the Office of Native Medicine, to conduct a minor ceremony. But because the patient had signed an advance directive, the practitioners had to deny the request. That makes sense in our Western world, right? Why is it a problem for the Navajo? Well, one, Navajo traditional practitioners tend to work with both patients and their family members. Remember I mentioned that there's some kind of imbalance going on? The practitioner will interview the patient they may go many years back in their history to try to figure out the source of that imbalance, but they'll also interview the family members to see if they can figure out what it is, because that determines what kind of ceremony needs to be done. It's not unusual for the patient and family members to disagree in traditional Navajo cases, but family members discuss the steps that should be taken on behalf of the patient. That is part of their responsibility as relatives. Okay, now that may not seem important to us, but let me give you this little tidbit here. For Navajo, the worst thing you can say to another Navajo is he or she behaves like they have no relatives. There are rules and expectations for behavior towards your relatives. This is part of it. The end-of-life directives do not allow for consideration of family wishes. Okay. Two, Navajo traditional practitioners must establish clan relationships. Navajo identify themselves by four clans, their mothers, their fathers, and their grandparents. If the practitioner has a kinship connection to the patient, then certain rules come into play, including proper etiquette and reciprocal kinship obligations, which can contradict or challenge federal rules about patient confidentiality. A third conflict can arise if the patient or family requests a traditional diagnosis and determination of relevant interventions or ceremonies. Okay. Preparation for ceremonies, as well as the ceremony itself, takes considerable time. Some ceremonies can only be done during a certain season, so you'd have to wait for that season, or it may depend upon a certain phase of the moon. They can last anywhere from 1 to 8 days, so you can see the time that might be involved. So preparation for ceremonies may interfere with hospital treatment or schedules. So at Chin Lee, the hospital took steps to minimize some of these issues by constructing a hogan on the grounds of the hospital for local practitioners to use when conducting brief ceremonies for patients and their families. In one wing of the hospital, they created this circular healing room with a round interior shaped like the inside of a hogan. This room is used by the O&M staff for patient consultation or for minor ceremonies when the patient is too ill to leave the hospital. The hospital grounds also have 2 sweat lodges, 1 for men and 1 for women. By providing such facilities, Chin Lee Hospital has reduced the amount of time needed for preparation and travel, and the patient remains near medical facilities. By providing hogan-like facilities, elder patients can experience the hospital as a place where the cause of their illness is treated and not as a place of death. Okay. So to sum up all of this, Navajo willingness to discuss end-of-life directives benefited from cultural sensitivity training on the part of health professionals, although there were some hang-ups at first, accommodation for traditional healing ceremonies, and a change of attitude among Navajos toward physicians who they no longer saw as purveyors of death, but as healers who can provide topic treatment in concert with Navajo traditional healing practices. By incorporating culturally sensitive accommodations for Navajo, Navajo participation in end-of-life directives went from 0 to a 90% rate at Fort Defiance Indian Hospital. Although signing end-of-life directives raises issues of kinship responsibility, they also no longer mean rejection of Navajo belief in traditional medicine, but rather participation in a larger process of treating symptoms along with the cause. Okay, thank you.
Can I say you killed that? Very well done. That was so clear and so lovely. We have lots of time for questions. You want to take a few minutes to think, or does anyone have a question immediately?
Fort Defiance. That's in New Mexico, I believe. Trying to remember where Fort Defiance, that's the name of the town too. And Chinle is the name of the town too. Yeah. There, the Navajo are located in what's called the Four Corners region, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, but they're mostly in Arizona. And actually, I take it back, Fort Defiance is probably in Arizona, the northeast part of Arizona. I'm not positive though, so don't quote me. I should know my geography better. Yes. It's not blaming the victim, because Navajo recognize that malevolence exists in the world. And when we're talking about that, the dynamism in the universe, then it's a constant, you could call it a battle with that malevolence, right? They have a ceremony called Blessing Way. It's a prophylactic ceremony. No one's sick, no one's injured, but you go through this process, this ceremony, which takes a lot of time and preparation to move yourself towards that state of balance, that state of Hojong. So if someone's dying a premature death, the idea is that something happened to maybe offend the holy beings, and I'm probably not pronouncing that quite right, I don't speak Navajo, but offending them. I talked about the winds that are inside people. That has been translated as ghosts or souls. From what I understand, it's really not a ghost or soul as we understand it in the West, but a human body has several of them in their body. The world consists of 12 winds, 6 in the upper world, 6 in the lower world. That wind can transmit messages, if you will, that lets the holy beings know when something is out of balance or wrong, and that they're offended by it. Once that imbalance is there, they can respond to it by causing illness. Okay. Yes. Let's say someone goes to war. They recognize that someone is going, that there's malevolence all around them at war. They would recognize that. So Navajo back home might be doing prayers. The enemy way, right, I believe, to try to protect that person while they're around that malevolence. So if they die, it's the malevolence surrounding that battlefield, whatever's going on there. War itself is malevolent. So it's not the person hasn't done something wrong who decided to join the military service. They would be seen as heroes. There would be memorials for them. There would be extended funeral services for them to recognize their contribution. I'm not sure if I'm getting at your question here. And that's why the diagnostician will interview the patient and the family. They're trying to find the cause. Now, the person might have done something that contributed to that cause. Maybe they violated some rule or something. And so that has to be corrected, okay, through ceremony, by calling on the Holy Spirit.